Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio, live from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, May 18, 2023. South Sudanese officials explore the LAMO project with their regional counterparts.
The government of Kenya also is committed to tarmacking the road from LAMO to Isiolo. Already a good progress has been made.
And hundreds of young women and men in Jonglei State take up commercial fishing.
I was in Uganda. When I heard that there is an opportunity here, I came here to do it since it worked that I am able to do. When I came, I managed to finish 4 bundles of salt on fish.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Ministers from Kenya, Ethiopia, and South Sudan are in Juba working out the details of the LAMO Port South Sudan-Ethiopia Transport, or LPSSET, project. The 3-day conference is aimed at fast-tracking the implementation of the project to ensure peace, growth, and regional integration. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
The three ministers are reviewing how far the LAPSET objective of the 2063 Africa Union's regional integration agenda has been achieved 11 years down the line. The project was launched in March 2012 by the governments of Kenya, Ethiopia, and South Sudan to streamline regional trade. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Roads, Transport and Public Works, Kichumba Murkomen, says his country has finished a road connecting Lamu Port to Moyale near Kenya's border with Ethiopia and is constructing a 730-kilometer road connecting Lamu Port to Lokichar and Nakodok area of Nadapal border with South Sudan.
The government of Kenya also is committed to tarmacking the road from Lamu to Isiolo. Already a good progress has been made. We are putting together resources to ensure that we complete and to make sure that also from Isiolo to Lokichar, which is the remaining bit, is also completed, so that then we can connect Kenya to South Sudan the same way we've done already from Nairobi to Moyale, which connects Ethiopia. We believe that by doing so, we will unlock a huge potential in our three countries, and we will also not just build on infrastructure, but also provide avenues for development along all these roads.
Once the LAPSET project is finished, it will foster industrialization, connectivity, food security, and regional stability, said Murkomen. Speaking at the same conference, Ethiopia's finance minister, Eyop Tekalin, says despite internal challenges all three countries face, they must move forward with the LAPSET project to bolster economic growth.
We are committed to this grand vision, but to convert this vision into clear and tangible economic dividend, these mega projects desire joint efforts from all of us and require significant private sector, business community participation, and also a serious investment from development partners.
Tekalin urged South Sudan government to show its commitment by investing money in the project. South Sudan Vice President Taban Dengai, who leads the government's infrastructure cluster, admits Juba has done little to implement its part of the project. He says work on the Juba to Rit Nadapal Road, which connects South Sudan to Kenya, was stalled because outside investors pulled out of the project despite South Sudan's stated committed to repay the loan.
The money was there to do this road even before Kenya. But when we went into crisis in 2016, the first group to withdraw from this funding was the World Bank, and then followed by the African Development Bank. The support we need from Ethiopia today and from Kenya and from Africa Commission is that these three bodies, the World Bank, China Exim Bank, and Africa Development Bank, should return to funding this road.
South Sudan Minister of Transport Madud Biari Yale says although the government remains far behind its schedule on implementing its part of the LAPSET, the project must continue because it will transform lives and alleviate poverty.
The LAPSET corridor holds immense promise of benefits for our regions and the continent at large. Such benefits include, but not limited to, A. Foster a transport linkage between the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Republic of Kenya, the Republic of South Sudan, and linking with Central African Republic and Cameroon to the athletic coast of West Africa. B, dynamic promotion of regional integration and socio-economic development along the transport corridor, especially in the northern, eastern, and coastal part of Kenya, southern Ethiopia, and South Sudan.
The LAPSET Corridor Program is Eastern Africa's largest and most ambitious infrastructure project, which includes Port Lamu in Kenya, inter-regional highways, a crude oil pipeline, communication networks, railway lines, and three airports. It is expected to benefit at least 250 million people in the region. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
South Sudan Prison Services authorities say inmates at prison facilities across the country are facing critical food shortages. Administrators say food suppliers have stopped delivering food to prisons because the Ministry of Finance has not paid them in 7 months. Deng Gaideng has the details for VOA Fombor.
The director of the prison service in Jonglei State, Brigadier General Bol Adur, tells VOA about 400 inmates at the Bol Central Prison have nothing to eat, as the prison food stock has run out. He says the food supplies that normally come from Juba are no longer being delivered.
I am now in the secretariat looking for food because contractors are not paid. They will not deliver food to the prison. Food situation is desperate.
Ring Awich, director of the prison service in Warabi State, says inmates in his area also face a food crisis. Awich says the inmates at state-run prisons are likely to starve if the national government doesn't intervene.
There is no food for inmates, and this is because they have stopped bringing the food because they have not been paid. We are now trying to talk to the state governor to have huts with food to feed the inmates while we wait for the contractors to come with food.
Major General Tangun Tombe, a spokesperson of the South Sudan Prison Service, says inmates at prison facilities across the country are going hungry because food suppliers have not been paid in months. He says food suppliers had earlier threatened to stop delivering supplies on May 1st if they were not paid.
As of now, we are speaking, these contractors are going 7 or 8 months without getting their money. So it becomes really an issue, because if you are not paid and you are supplying like Juba Central Prison, which is housing almost 3,000 inmates, imagine the food for 3,000 inmates in a day, how much it costs. It's a huge money. And if you continue to feed them in a month, for 7 months and you are not getting money, you are then I don't think how can you work. Then the work become a little bit of a challenge.
Tombe says the prison service has written to the Minister of Interior about the fact that prisons are running out of food for inmates, which prompted him to urge the finance ministry to expedite payment to contractors.
We have to report to the Minister of Interior that look, contractors are not being paid for this, and we'll be reporting. We're not reporting, we are writing letters because this is a responsibility. Because should there be any riot, then the Minister of Interior will come in. And then the Minister of Interior will ask the prison service what happened. Then we shall tell him that we have written to you.
The South Sudan National Prison Service falls under the Ministry of Interior. Major General Daniel Justins, a spokesperson of the South Sudan Police Service, who is also a spokesperson for the National Ministry of Interior, says documents about the need to pay food contractors have been submitted to the finance ministry. He says the delay is coming from that ministry.
What I know so far is that the documents all are in the Ministry of Finance. So the issue is how to pay them, how the problem. Priorities with the Ministry of Finance and our municipal government. So they are waiting payment. But because it has taken some time, that is why the contractors decided to stop until they are paid something.
Teke Steben is the spokesperson for the Ministry of Finance.
I have no information about that yet. Maybe unless I inquire from the office, I did not come across that yet.
Justin says Interior Ministry officials are working to ensure payments are processed as soon as possible so that inmates can be fed. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
Amid the soaring jobless rate, some young people in Jonglei State's Bor County have taken up commercial fishing, including women, students and military personnel. In Adwar, hundreds of young people earn a living by catching fish, cleaning them and exporting them to neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Manyang David Mayar has the story for VOA from Bor.
At the Adwar fishing site, 23-year-old Joel Thornmayol scoops up tilapia in a fishing net and dumps the fish into the bottom of his small wooden canoe where they flap back and forth. Thorn says in April he was busy studying hard in school, but a lack of money for school fees forced him out of the classroom and launched him into the world of fishing.
I was in Uganda. When I heard that there is an opportunity here, I came here to do it since it worked that I am able to do. When I came, I managed to finish 4 bundles of salt on fish. When I took it to the market, I managed to get some money and use it to buy this canoe. Now, I am starting to get more money for other things and school fees.
Thorn says he has earned 400,000 South Sudanese pounds, or a little over $400, in less than a month of fishing. 24-year-old Makokur, who completed his secondary school education this year, is salting and drying hundreds of fish in Adwar. He says he switched to fishing after looking and failing to land a formal job in the area.
Instead, to start to waste my time in Bor or give it to look for a job, I decided to come and start this work. So I'm working here, I'm comfortable with this work. I have almost 2 months now. The first time I came here, I spent 2 weeks. I get 900,000 pounds in 2 weeks. You know, there's a lot of challenges in this country, the country that we are in. They corrupt many things. So there's no need of me to waste my time there to look for a job.
Several members of the organized forces, such as Ding Magot, recently got involved with fishing and preserving the fish by salting it at the Adwar fishing site.
I have been a soldier. When the pay became less, I switched to teaching. And again, there was no pay. So I decided to come here working throughout the night. I sleep only for 2 hours. I hear some of our leaders saying that the youths are lazy. Who is actually lazy between the leaders who are not serving the people and the people supposed to be served?
Tong Bora Chek, chairman of Jonglei Fisheries Traders Union, says commercial fishing only started becoming popular in the state in 2020.
We only knew how to get fish for food, and it was not sold for money. Recently, God said changed our lives. Congolese, Ugandans, and Rwandans came to us and showed us how to survive on fish. So we learned to catch our fish, salt, and even take it to Congo and Uganda. It is the one that we are surviving. It is one of the things in South Sudan that are exported.
Achek says more than 5,000 people have become fishermen and women in Bor. Since 2020, he says Jonglei has been exporting about 160 tons of fish per week, but the endeavor comes with its own set of challenges. There are multiple taxes along the way to the market in Uganda and Congo, and insecurity continues to be a problem. Atongkwal Manyang, Jonglei State's Minister of Animal Resources, Fisheries and Tourism, admits some authorities are illegally collecting taxes from fish traders. She also says fishing needs to be regulated to protect the river from being overfished.
So as a government, or especially the ministry, We need to take this more seriously so that our people, the fishermen themselves, will know exactly when to fish, what kind of nets to use. And if somebody catches a small fish, for example, that is supposed to be for tomorrow, that can grow and breed, is not caught. And if somebody is caught with that, what are the repercussions?
Kual says fishermen and women should also be licensed to restrict overfishing. She says officials worry that far more people will take up fishing in the coming weeks and months due to the country's poor economic conditions. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Bor.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, half of Sudan's population needs humanitarian assistance, according to the United Nations. Stay tuned for that report right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's a bad habit that you have struggled to give up?
Bad habit. I love sleeping a lot. Yeah, that's my bad habit. I love sleeping. Sometimes I fail to catch up on time because of sleep.
That habit of being jealous to my wife, yes, that one. I've tried to be to control myself so that I should not be jealous of her, but I do fail.
A short temper, because I think that it is a genetic, so I can not give up.
I tend to overreact and make kids do something wrong, and I end up regretting the consequences of my actions after giving them too tough punishments.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The United Nations says more than half of Sudan's population now needs aid and protection. Civilians are seeking shelter from airstrikes and sporadic clashes that continue between rival military factions in the Khartoum area. Residents say power was cut, food is in short supply, and drinking water is scarce due to the violent power struggle now in its second month despite international mediation efforts. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the Obama administration and senior advisor at the Albright Stone Bridge Group at the United States Institute of Peace, Ambassador Johnny Carson, tells VOA's Yahya Zuhib no one expected what's happening in Sudan.
Situation in Sudan is tragic and horrible for all the people of that country, but especially the people in the capital city of Khartoum. I think no one expected the kind of conflict that has emerged over the last 3.5 weeks that has left that city partially destroyed and hundreds of thousands of people homeless and on the move. There is an immediate need for humanitarian assistance to get into Khartoum and into Sudan as fast as possible. Everyone who has an opportunity as a nation or a government to help address the humanitarian situation should do so. I know there are ongoing efforts to try to broker another ceasefire, but it is imperative that pressure be put on all of the parties to engage in a cessation of hostility, to allow humanitarian aid and assistance to get into that country. The movement of peoples not only undermines the stability inside of Sudan, but it has a huge impact on all of the neighboring countries that are receiving refugees from that tragic situation.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last Monday regarding American citizens in Sudan, since you were like the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, American citizens in Sudan have told the U.S. government that they want to leave, but the State Department is providing them with advice and guidance, but there are still no plans to offer them transportation because it is too dangerous, according to Mr. Blinken. And there is an estimated 16,000 Americans in Sudan, many of them dual nationals. So what is the policy of the United States in situations like this?
The United States tends to do as best it can to stay in contact with American citizens. Consular sections routinely send out messages to citizens in a country. The consular section is closed, but I think neighboring countries and the U.S. government are, in fact, trying to maintain contact with U.S. citizens who are currently in Sudan. There were several efforts, as I understand it, by the U.S. government to arrange for those Sudanese citizens, Sudanese American citizens who wanted to leave the country, to do so. But the situation on the ground is dangerous, but I think the U.S. government is continuing to try to maintain email contact with those individuals, giving them information as best it can on how they might be able to leave the country. Warnings were issued, I think, very clearly over the last several weeks, encouraging American citizens, dual nationals, to leave the country. And there were several convoys that were arranged by the State Department for individuals to leave the country. The situation is dangerous, but it is the responsibility of those citizens to take care of themselves, to look out after themselves. But it is a dangerous situation. I think there's still an ongoing effort to try to provide those individuals with information on how they might be able to leave the country.
That's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Johnny Carson speaking with VOA's Yahya Zuhib. Still in Sudan, where hospitals and health facilities have struggled to keep operating since intense fighting broke out in Khartoum last month. A medical and surgical team from Doctors Without Borders has started treating patients at Bashair Teaching Hospital on the outskirts of Khartoum as ongoing violence severely increases medical needs in the city and other regions of Sudan. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Will Harper, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Khartoum, to find out more.
Doctors Without Borders is currently working in South Khartoum. We're running a surgical and ER in the Bashir Teaching Hospital in South Khartoum. We arrived 2 weeks ago for a rapid assessment, and then we've been active treating cases and saving lives in this hospital for the past 10 days.
What type of patients are you getting? Are these bullet wounds? Or what type of patients do you have?
Doctors Without Borders, our team on the ground here working with the volunteers and staff here in the hospital, we're seeing, to put it simply, the impact of war, full stop. We're seeing gunshot wounds, victims of bomb blasts, shelling. We're also seeing the surgical needs that exist in a city the size of Khartoum, traffic accidents and things impacting civilian life daily. Our first day of intervention, we saw 60 gunshot wounds come through the hospital. My team last night was in the operating theater until 5 a.m. So the needs are pretty enormous, and the number of cases coming through, traumatic injuries, complex surgeries, and then also just the post-operative care, treating patients to control infection and be able to insist on a good outcome is a real challenge for us.
How secure is your facility since the fighting is still ongoing?
That's a good question. The Bashair Teaching Hospital is in Khartoum City, in South Khartoum. It's an area that we selected. We had access to. People have access to the hospital, but we're on the zone. I mean, we hear the bombs dropping even now. If the speaker can pick it, the gunshots and smoke rising from the city of Khartoum, where the active fighting is. So we needed to be in a hospital that is close enough to the front line, close enough to the conflict to have an impact, to save those lives in that time it takes for people to get to us. But we also need to be in a place that keeps our staff safe and that patients are comfortable to be here. So we're really trying to find that zone in between, and this is where we've set up operations for now.
I understand you're working with the local doctors as well. Are these government employees? What type of doctors are you working with?
Yeah, it's a real mix of people that are supporting this this hospital. So Doctors Without Borders, working with volunteers from the community, from the local area, as well as doctors, nurses, medical staff who have volunteered their time, Sudanese healthcare workers that are also committed to this, to making this hospital functioning. So this hospital was completely non-functional. Volunteer initiative started it, and then we've come in to really bring that extra surgical capacity, bringing in international staff, supplies, and a bit of extra on top to really make this into a functioning surgical referral center. So we have a long way to go, but the hospital is open 24/7. We're seeing patients coming in from quite far away, even other areas of the city, as the word spreads that Doctors Without Borders is here to provide free healthcare to anyone who can access this hospital. And I think that's really a piece of this that we're trying to, beyond the medical care, it's that humanitarian imperative, and to create a space that's neutral, impartial, insisting on our humanitarian principles and providing quality free healthcare in a war zone. That's what this whole project is about.
Given the enormity of the work you're doing there and the people who are in dire stress, how do you get your supplies? Do you have enough supplies to cope with the task at hand?
The supply question is a big one, and the short answer is not yet. We are bringing in supplies that we had in the country. MSF Belgium, we had a warehouse about 10 or 15 minutes away that we were able to access and pull some supplies from. We've gotten supply from some of the other MSF sections, the Doctors Without Borders sections, MOH supply, and we just landed yesterday a cargo plane with almost 30 tons of medical supply into Port Sudan. It's on the road traveling towards Khartoum as we speak. So the supplies are coming in. We need more support with that. We as Doctors Without Borders have lost supply as well due to looting and theft. Some of the warehouses have been broken into. So all of those impacts of the conflict are impacting our ability to provide health care. Fuel is another question. The electric power grid is inconsistent at best, and of course we can't have a power outage during an operation. So procuring diesel fuel and clean water just to keep this hospital running adds to the challenges beyond the medical work.
That's Will Harper, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Khartoum, speaking with my colleague Douglas Impuga. And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Fatoumata. We leave you with Fatoumata Diawara and the song Interini. We've been listening to Fatoumata Diawara and the song Interini. I am your host, Nabil Biagio, in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. So am I.